Hello and welcome to The Runs, the podcast in which we discuss runs of comic books. I'm your host, Ryan Alexander Tanner. This week we'll be talking about Zap Comics by R. Crumb and some other guys. And my guest is Bob Fingerman. Bob Fingerman has a long and eclectic career in comics. He's done comics for Mad, Cracked, Heavy Metal, National Lampoon. He's done both pornographic comics and children's comics, which is good to say in one sentence, I think. He's probably best known for the semi-autobiographical comic series Minimum Wage. Does that sound right?
That sounds right.
All right. And did I leave anything out?
I don't disagree with anything you've said there, so...
Okay, that's a good response to an introduction. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I always do a little context just to let the listener know kind of what they're dealing with. So we don't really know each other very well, but I have met you. It's our relationship. Yeah. I don't think we've spoken in 10 years or something.
Yeah, that's it, probably at least that long. And I'm trying to remember, did you and I meet at a comic shop in Brooklyn?
I don't think so. So I had a year-ish where I was in Brooklyn, and, you know, there's sort of that web of people. I always feel like Dean Haspiel is sort of the centerpiece of this whole Brooklyn comic scene. And so I only met you through that. I think I remember really talking to you at a wedding of a comics artist.
Maybe Joe Infernari.
Joe Infernari's wedding, yeah.
All right, there we go. My memory isn't completely shot.
That's when I remember kind of chopping it up with you. Yeah, that was a fun kind of gathering of comics people. And then, yeah, I think we've just been sort of social media adjacent since then. And you were definitely someone that I met and I knew who you were from your work. I read Minimum Wage in college, you know. And also, I think I could say, as I was thinking about having you on the show, I think you're sort of a cartoonist that I relate to in the sense that we both have kind of weirdly eclectic careers, I think.
Now, I think that's definitely a fair assessment of my trajectory. It's kind of been all over the road.
Where do you think that comes from for you? Why is it such a range of work?
Well, I think partly some of it is survival, you know, because some of it's like, okay, well, I better do a bunch of things because there's not only going to be one kind of thing. So, you know, I started my career in a way. I mean, I started with comics because my first regular gig was Cracked Magazine, but I was also doing lots of freelance illustration in those days. And partly that was to make a living and, you know, get my work out there. But also, I think there's always been kind of a restless quality to my creativity where I get tired of things and want to try something new.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sometimes it's been a good fit. Sometimes it's been a less good fit. But at least I can say I've tried different stuff.
Yeah, I relate to that restlessness. I've never called it that, but that's a good term for it. Like, I can't imagine, like, and I don't have a criticism of someone doing this, but I can't imagine drawing like Charlie Brown for 60 years. You know, it just seems like, don't you want to, I don't know. I love different projects and like figuring out how it works and what it'll look like and that sort of approach to things. So, and I feel like it's been a little detrimental to me professionally. Like maybe if people go, oh, you're the horror artist, here's a horror project. Like it's more a straight line, you know, but
oh, it's absolutely detrimental because, you know, let's face it, people tend to like to consume media where they know what they're getting. They find the thing they like and then they want more of that thing they like. I mean, obviously, there's plenty of people who like a diverse entertainment and so forth. But, you know, the things, especially the people who make it in our field, generally they are. Yeah, they're known for, oh, that's the guy who does, and, you know, fill in the name of the character. Mm-hmm. And then it's like there's literally 30 years of that character.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's great. And in a lot of ways, I wish I had that wiring, but I don't. I'm not so in love with anything I've ever come up with where I thought, well, that's it for me. That's the rest of my career.
Yeah. Do you feel like you've made it in comics? I love that question.
I don't know. I don't know what, I definitely don't want to be a sour grapes person because that's a very bad look. I'm grateful for, the success I've had. Is it the success I wanted? No, but it is success. I've managed to do a career of predominantly doing work that has meaning to me and that I was invested in. And, for good or for ill, it pretty much was uncompromised. So, those are different kinds of success. I think part of the problem, certainly like when I'm looking at myself in a sort of meta way, I'm looking down at myself and thinking, what is success? So much of that is societal. It's like, what does society see as success? So in societal terms, no, I'm not a success.
Why is
But,
that?
well, because, have I made a really good living? Have I got, it's all about cash. I mean, let's face it, we're in a very, this is a capitalist society, and, people are generally measured by financial success way more than by do they feel fulfilled as human beings? Nobody looks, nobody has an index. We all have those Forbes lists of wealthiest, but there's no who is feeling sort of creatively and spiritually fulfilled list. For one
I
thing,
would
I think
love to see that list.
that would kind of probably bump up against something so pure. But in a way, it would be interesting if some magazine maybe did an annual poll of creative people saying, how fulfilled do you feel?
I would love to see that. Yeah, that would be very interesting. No, yeah. And like Michael Jackson wouldn't do well on that, like obviously in back in the day, but one of the wealthiest and most, but yeah, no, I mean some people get really chewed up by their fame and success too. So yeah. No, these are great questions for working cartoonists, I think, or like what is success has been such a big question to me. And it's
And
changed too as I've gotten older.
yeah, and by the way, look at the people who tend to be on the more tangible financial success thing. So many of them just you could tell have screaming voids of emptiness. That's really money is the only thing that fills the hole. That's it. When you look at somebody who's got $100 billion and their only goal is to have another 100 billion, that's about the emptiest person you could ever see, because nothing can fill it. There you go, man. I'm a success.
You're a success, so
Yeah,
celebrate.
I'm doing what I do for 40 years professionally, and I still love it. So I guess that's a success.
I think it is. I really do. And you got a room. I'm looking at your office on Zoom. It looks pretty cool. You got some nice books and brushes and things. So yeah, it's all relative.
Yeah, I got my creature comforts, so yeah.
Right on.
Have a great relationship, have two cute dogs, so yeah.
What more do you need? So we're going to talk today about a minor success in comics, Robert Crumb. I don't know if you've heard of him, but so Zap Comics, here's just kind of a rough overview. You can correct me or add to it. So this is R. Crumb's breakout series. This was sort of when he became a name, I believe. So it debuted in 1968. The first issue was famously sold out of a baby stroller on Haight-Ashbury. That's sort of an iconic image. And it pretty much kicked off the underground comics movement, if I'm not mistaken. This was like the cathexis of that whole thing. And it becomes an anthology series, I think, with the second issue. And then it ran for 17 issues over 46 years, a sort of recurring project. The last issue came out in 2016, but this is sort of the game changer. And we're going to talk about that. I try not to get into it ahead of the show, like talk about the work at all, but you had a little concerns about how we would talk about this. And it's one big question of this show is like, did you have to be there? Like, does it hold up in hindsight? And this is maybe one of the biggest, there are elements of this that I think do hold up, but this is a really major, you have to look at the context type of a work, I think.
Yeah, well, it was interesting revisiting these because, the truth is, here's how the sausage is made, folks. I hadn't reread these in ages. It was one of these things where it's like I remember, when I was a young fella in my teens, going and to use sort of era-appropriate lingo, I was looking to score these, issues of underground comics because I never really was a mainstream comics guy. But once I mean, I was exposed to this stuff too young, because I saw like an anthology of it when I was probably less than 7 or 8 years old.
And what did that do to you?
Well, it terrified me.
Yeah.
Because kids, especially really little kids, you don't have a visual vocabulary for stuff that's particularly not meant for your eyes. And so I remember distinctly there was an image. It was at a bookstore in New York called Brentano's. And for whatever reason, this book was on a low shelf. It really should have been on a high shelf. But while my mom was off probably browsing mystery paperbacks or whatever, I wandered off to where the cartoon books were. And there was the Apex Bijou Treasury. And I was just paging through it. And I think my first, I don't know if it was my actual first exposure to Robert Crumb's work, because his posters were ubiquitous when I was a kid, because I mean, I'm older than you. I'm too young for the hippie era to have been part of it, but I was a little kid when the hippie era was kind of coming to its more cynical ending. But you used to see R. Crumb posters everywhere. They were every basically newsstand. I mean, not newsstand, but like news kiosk that sold cigarettes and newspapers. Almost all of them, you would see a Keep on Truckin' or the Stoned Again poster with the guy whose face is melting. They were everywhere. But the first one that really jarred me was in that Treasury, and it was this character, Pro Junior, 69ing his girlfriend, Honey Bunch Kaminsky. And it just looked it I mean, obviously, colloquially they're eating each other, but to my little brain, they were actually cannibalizing each other, because it's very kind of goopy and horrific. And I was terrified. I remember just slamming the cover on that thing, putting it back on the shelf, and probably running off to cling to my mother's leg. So, that was too soon. It's too soon. I was
Too
too
soon.
young.
So, what's your relationship with these Zap comics, though, specifically?
Well, again, to contextualize things, fast forward to junior high school. And I'm an only child, so I didn't have any particularly older sibling who was the cooler one who gets you hip to the good stuff and music and all that kind of thing. But I did have a classmate, my friend Charlie Bonet, who he was like that one anomalous kid who it's just like, you don't fit in with all the rest of these really regular Queens kids in my little in my Queens junior high school. He was cool. Like he looked different. He had his whole thing going on, but he had underground comics, and including really, really dirty ones. Like he had stuff like Snatch and all that kind of thing. And even at 13, I was like, yikes, this is pretty gnarly. But he had Zap. And I remember looking at that and thinking, oh, wow, this is cool. And I think it probably was one of the solo Crumb issues, because I remember just looking at it and it was different in that it was like, oh, this is just one guy kind of doing a bunch of different stuff. And it's black and white, which of course, it stood out. You're so used to comic books, or at least I was so used to comic books being full color, and you see this black and white thing. There was just something very tantalizing and forbidden about it. And so that was when I thought, okay, I got to go seek these out. And I'm a minor, and I also looked young for my age, because I was like that tiny kid. So I looked, even though I was 14 at that point, I probably looked 12. On a good day, I was very small. And so, you're looking for something that very clearly is adults only. And A, it's not like there were stores all over the place that sold that kind of thing, especially in my neighborhood. And when I found there was a really great comic store, way ahead of its time, called Little Nemo. And the guy who owned that store, was the kind of guy that probably now he would be pilloried, but he could see that I wasn't just a tourist. He could see that I was invested in what I was looking for. And I think, he and I, we had some good conversations. He knew that I was an aspiring cartoonist. And, he had original comic art and flat files. I remember him showing me original, speaking of Nemo, Winsor McCay pages that he had and
Whoa,
seeing how
that's
huge they
cool.
were. I remember he had the French artist Philippe Drouet, and his originals were enormous. And so, he was kind of sales, he was a merchant, but he was also a little bit of a mentor. But he didn't gatekeep, even though he probably should have. I mean, he definitely was like, don't tell your parents or whatever. But he sold me underground comics, bless
Yeah,
his.
there was less concern, there's become more and more concern over the years of like what you share with kids, like,
Yeah, well, yeah, I always say, I grew up in, I mean, having grown up in the 70s, and that was a very feral decade. It was a very kind of unsupervised. I remember Terry Laban had a comic called Unsupervised Existence. That really, in a lot of ways, I mean, it's not like my mom was a very good mother, and she definitely kept tabs on me, but it wasn't the kind of tab, it wasn't helicopter. It was like she kind of knew what I was up to, but she didn't really know what I was up to because, I was free range. I was a latchkey kid and I was free range, and I would wander way beyond where I was supposed to be wandering, and so that afforded a kind of, you got to satisfy your curiosity about things because it's like, oh, I walked 15 blocks from home today. Oh, I'm going to walk 20 blocks from home today. It's just like, I'm going to keep going further and further. Oh, I didn't get killed. I guess it's okay. I'll keep
But
going.
for you, as like a generation maybe later or like one and a half than this, like what is the impact of Zap Comics on you as a creative and as a person and all that?
Well, it definitely was. It and Heavy Metal Magazine showed me comics do not need to be for kids, and they don't need, to be, I didn't know a word like franchise, but they don't need to be a superhero, an IP that's not yours. It definitely showed me, oh, comics can be the work of an individual. I knew comic strips could be, because I certainly had plenty of experience of seeing very individualistic comic strips, and those also hugely had an impact on my creativity. But I found the format and restrictions of daily comic strips unenticing. It was just like, oh yeah, you mentioned before, this thing of doing something for 60 years or whatever. So I knew at a pretty young age, it's like, well, I don't want to do that. But seeing underground comics, where it was this chaos of ideas and really idiosyncratic styles that clearly would not flourish anywhere else, it definitely let me know, oh, okay, there's a future in the kind of thing I want to do creatively.
That's cool. And so I'll do mine real quick and then we can kind of talk about the contemporary response to these, which is so for me, Crumb, because I'm, generation after you, I would say one thing that's important to me that I'll put up front of this is like there's this question now of like what do we do with problematic art or problematic creators and things like that. And the phrase I always land on is both of these things are true. Like So I had never sat down and read Zap Comics before. I think I had two older brothers, and we all read comics, and that was very formative for me. And my mom read comics and got us comics. So I remember her getting my oldest brother one of the volumes of the Complete Crumb comics, and I was probably eight. That was like 1990, and sort of looking at it, but not sitting down to read it. And then in probably 92, 90, whenever it came out, my mom took me to see the Crumb documentary. And that
Oh,
was
yeah.
my first, like, I had a cool mom. I had the first, like, kind of full blown, like, okay, look at this and the context of it. And I still love that documentary. That documentary makes me want to sit and draw comics. You know, it's like warts and all, but it's a very inspiring, you know, it's like listening to a great album or something. It makes you want to do something. And I think after seeing that, I would kind of I did check out that Complete Crumb collection, which had some of these comics in it. There's some overlap there, but Crumb is never, I can very much acknowledge Crumb. He's a game changer as a technical artist and as a conceptual artist. I think he's a genius. Like, I think that's fair to say. And also, I don't really like reading his comics that much. Like, there's not a simple Crumb work where you go like, oh, you're interested in Crumb, read this thing. You know, it's more like the overall. I think the only Crumb collections I own, or I have one of the sketchbook collections, those are just great. And then when Book of Genesis came out, I bought that and actually read the whole thing. And that to me is like a really high. He's one of those artists that's just gotten better for forever, I would say. And the craft of his Book of Genesis is like unbelievable, I would say. But yeah, I don't. And what he did for Autobio, I have a high regard for. You know, he's sort of the start of confessional type comics. And I'm very impacted by kind of the generation that was impacted by him, like, you know, Chester Brown and Joe Matt and those guys, like, the people that came after him, that was really formative to me. And I have a lot of respect for Crumb. But I had a hard time getting through these comics. Really, like, I was telling my wife last night about what are we going to do. And I was like, you know, I think you had to be on acid in 1968 to really made me want to drop some acid, which I haven't done in 25 years or something, you know. I mean, it didn't really, but this to me is a major you had to be there. I can very much acknowledge, you know, this was like at the height of Marvel Comics when these came out. This really does, like, this is breaking barriers and saying, like, you can make comics like this. There was like no precedent for this, pretty much, right?
I mean, obviously there's debate about, you know, what was the real first underground comic. I know some people say it's Joel Beck's Larry of Laredo. See, there you go. Who's talking about Larry of Laredo other than,
You
you know,
are. Yeah, we'll do that next.
nerds who do the deep dives. But here's where, when you asked me what run of comics we should talk about, and I threw a few things at you, and one had already been taken by somebody else. So I sort of just kind of grasping for things suggested Zap. But here's the thing: as I say, it had been a long time since I had looked at these, and the truth is, and there's going to be plenty to talk about, but the truth is, I unlike you, I love Crumb, but this is probably my least favorite period of Crumb's creative output, specifically because what you said about needing to be on LSD, you know, he was on LSD, and frankly, I think his work suffered for it. It unlocked creative pathways in his brain that I think were very valuable, especially in the long term of his creativity. It got him, in a lot of ways, it got him out of his own way. But I don't really read that stuff and connect with it very much. Like, to me, my favorite era of Crumb is, well, it's more than an era. But like the work he did in Weirdo, he was at the top of his both artistic powers, but his writing had really sharpened. Like he had gotten a much more satirical edge, and you know, he was doing, I think, work that had much greater depth. The stuff in Zap is, somebody is going to get mad at me for saying this, but it's fairly superficial.
Yeah.
It's very surface. You know, even something like the famous strip Meatball, where it's all these people getting hit on the head with a meatball, which I guess was sort of thumbing his nose at you know, pop spiritualism and all that kind of thing, where it's, you know, and he just shrugged. Most of these strips also end with a shrug, where it's kind of like, well, I didn't know how to end it, so it's over, you know,
on
this thing. They're all very half-baked, probably because he was fully baked. So, I don't know. It's, and the drawing, I like when he got a little bit, maybe more uptight in his art, you know, where he really was. To me, the best eras of Crumb are the pre-hippie era, because I love the stuff that he was doing for Harvey Kurtzman when he would go off and do his the little sketch assignments of go to Harlem or go to Prague or, you know, doing that kind of thing. And, you know, the early Fritz the Cat stuff, that stuff's great. And then he, you know, went off and joined the hippie culture. Even though it's pretty clear he always was sort of straddling hippie culture, because he certainly didn't embrace the music or this or that. I think he's very open about saying he loved the free love aspect of it, and he loved the creativity aspect, but he certainly didn't like other parts of it. So that's fair.
I think a lot of cartoonists, I myself, like, relate to that, sort of like, this is the closest I came to being a part of a specific scene, but I still sort of had my place outside of it. Like, I wasn't all in. I think cartoonists are very much not joiners in a lot of ways.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. When, you know, cause when I was a certain age, you know, for me, that's when the hardcore punk scene was happening. And, you know, I would go to the hardcore shows, but it was always like, oh, I like how angry and aggressive this is. And I like the music, but God, these people are horrible. Surrounded by, you know, it's one of those things where you look at the other people who are there and you just kind of go, some cute girls here, but this is, all these guys look like they would murder me.
All right. Or is this guy serious? Like, you really put that much work into being a part of this thing, like your whole image and you're sort of assigned all these things that you're into as yeah, I can't do it. I've never been able to go all in on any kind of, but yeah, like this first issue, I like that it's like a whole aesthetic. It's like you go into this thing and there's even these pieces of like, you know, fake ads and like it's all one complete hand drawn. There's not a straight line in the whole thing. I think maybe the fourth issue is the first time he uses a ruler on the borders, you know, and it's a little more kind of rendered. But I mean, yes, every strip you read, you're like, okay, this is kind of a stream of consciousness. I can see how it was so innovative at the time, but sitting down to read it is kind of like, ah, okay, yeah, you know.
Like, you can also see how it influenced certain things directly, because there was one strip in here called City of the Future. And when I was reading that one, my mind immediately went to Dan Clowes in one of the early issues of 8 Ball, where he did his whole thing of here's what it's going to be in the future.
Yeah.
And it was all these single panel in the future. Yep. People will do this and they will do that. And, you know, that's very much this strip. You won't have to do this. You can do that.
Yeah, it's almost
in
a
no
redo.
Way
yeah.
am I saying that, like, oh, my, look, Clowes did not rip anything off. I adore Clowes's work and 8 Ball, which was the run I wanted to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
He is one of the most unimpeachably brilliant runs of comics ever, but we're not here to talk about that. But you can see, because obviously Clowes is a self-proclaimed worshiper at the altar of Crumb, you know, stuff definitely seeped into him too. And, you know, I think probably if he and I were to both be looped in on this conversation. He did read superhero stuff. That was part of his DNA, which was never part of mine. But I'm sure because he did have his hippie older brother and he saw the underground comics at a young age, I guarantee that is part of what the pathway was for him of saying, oh, here's this completely individualistic thing. I like Spider-Man by Ditko. I don't want to draw Spider-Man. I'm going to go do what these weirdos did. So yeah, you know, Crumb, the other thing that you also have to think about contextually about Zap, particularly the solo issues with Crumb, is he was really shaking off the conventions of his upbringing of, because, you know, having been born when he was born, having been raised by, you know, a very, I get the impression from the documentary, from everything I've read, I'm pretty well read on Crumb. You know, he had a very uptight dad. His dad was the model for the character White Man in these, you know, in Zap. Crumb is a person who grew up basically just post-World War II. And, you know, then in coming of age in Eisenhower's America. And so for somebody who, and then, you know, he gets his kind of first regular gig working for American Greetings, doing greeting cards. And so he's, and then he, as he's his famous quote, you know, his father said, you're going to marry the first one who comes along. And so he did. So he did all these things that were kind of like, this is what you do. You're a man of this generation who's grown up in a very kind of suburban milieu. So he was rebelling. It's like he was really shaking off a lot of societal shackles. And so that's where, again, these are important because it's like, oh, this is a guy who he's got all these instincts based on the media that he consumed, funny animals and comic strips and this and that. But then he's been given freedom to not have to behave. And so not having to behave, and that's where you then get into what has aged well, what has not aged well.
Yeah.
And rereading these, there was a lot of, oh, geez.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Where you're just kind of like, okay, you know, I'm not going to, it's so easy to tar people with labels and go, oh, Crumb is a racist. Crumb definitely has issues with women. Again, self-professed. Yeah. No one has been more candid about their sort of love slash hate relationship with an entire, you know, half of the planet. But, you know, I think it's easy, like I say, it's easy to throw labels. I don't know, is the stuff, for all I know, maybe now I'm going to have people come at me. I don't know as he was consciously racist, but the work is racist. I think things can coexist.
Yeah, I think there's a question that comes, I mean, and again, I say that both of these things are true. And I think this comes up in the documentary, and I think it's, and I don't know R. Crumb, you know, I've never sat down with him. But I think it raises a question of, is he critiquing racism or is he expressing racism, you know? And it's a little ambiguous there. And I think one of the things that to me is sort of pivotal, there's a moment that happened, I don't have a sense of time anymore, in the last 10 years. I think at SPX, you know, the Small Press Expo, which is sort of like a indie comics hub. It's sort of like, here's what's happening in indie comics. And it was like an award show. And Crumb was mentioned and Crumb was booed by the audience. And I feel, this is where I really say both of these things are true. I feel like if you saw Angel Food McSpade and when you were growing up going to the comic store and it freaked you out and made you feel personally attacked. I can't tell you you're wrong to feel like that. I don't support Angel Food McSpade as a representation of anything. But also, so that's true. I'm not going to tell anyone they're wrong for having feelings. That is true. What's also true is SPX would not exist without our crumb. Like, this is a problematic person. This is a person who's both a great artist and a fucked up person. There's something about putting that on the page that's done, gotten us where we are creatively. It's open pathways. And that he's the start of this whole thing, this whole culture that we're all part of. And it's shifted, its values are shifted. And both those things are true. I think that's, you got to live with that.
Yeah, well, and this is also that whole thing. Well, one, you know, I'm not going to, I don't want to get into the buzzy words and things like cancel culture and all that. But, you know, there is definitely the separate art from the artist. And when do you draw the line? Because there are some cases where you're just like, oh, fuck that guy. I'm not, oh, I first on this show. I don't know.
Oh, I just said it. It's okay. Yeah.
Okay. But, you know, there are, over the course of history, you know, when you look back, there are two things that are very important. Context. Context is really king. They say content is king. Context is really king. You have to put things in the time in which they were done and the context in which they were done. You know, most, I mean, if you were going to do a list of the really kind of laudable, decent human beings who've created great art over the centuries, it would probably be a pretty short list. Does that make their work less great? You know, you look at history's great anti-Semites who also happen to create beautiful literature and music and art. Plenty of them. Do I hate looking at their work? I do not. You know, does that make me a bad person with the name Fingerman? I don't think so. You know, it's, you have to, there's a lot of words have been coined in recent memory that kind of cover where we are. And presentism was a word that came along a few years ago that to me is a very useful one of judging everything by the present standards. Well, for one thing, the standards of the present eventually become the standards of ago, and it doesn't take very long, you know. So you can be on a certain side of an issue in the present that's the right one, where maybe someday it will be the wrong one. Who knows? We don't know. We don't know what the future holds. But if you gauge everything by presentism, you do end up cutting a lot out of what you can enjoy. And, you know, maybe you do. Like I say, you contextualize things. You look at it and say, well, this certainly doesn't pass the standards of today. Does it have any merit? And somebody like Crum, who has such a vast body of work and also has very clearly wrestled with stuff, he's not someone who's particularly glib. He in the documentary, there are moments where he seems glib, but if you look past the surface, he's wrestling with stuff that entire time. You know, there's a scene where he's kind of chuckling. And by the way, I understand the chuckling thing. Chuckling is a nervous response.
Yeah. You
know?
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, when his brother, who ended up committing suicide, is talking about how miserable and depressed he is, and Crumb's just sitting there in the room with him and he's chuckling. He's not, it's not derisive. It's just more like you can laugh or cry, you know? And so it's, I think there's, people are very ready to judge without necessarily having all the information. This is a very read the headlines era, don't read the article. And, you know, when you read the article, that's when you can say, oh, okay, well, and then you can sort of calibrate your response. But if all you do is read the headlines, you know, we're in high dudgeon all the time. And that's partly because the internet has never made it easier for everyone to be angry all the time. And it's a very us versus them. You know, I don't see those as particularly positive developments. That also doesn't mean you accept everything that came in the past and just say, well, that's hunky-dory. Like I say, some things, but it's a good thing to, you don't want to monolithically throw someone like Crum away and just boo him, because he is, hey, I don't think he's a bad person. He's a fucked up person. That's a different thing. That's a whole different thing. You know,
that's a big question of our times for sure. Like who's fucked up and who should be removed from our space, you know, like that's a big question, but anyway, yeah.
So, you know, So to redirect back to the first couple of issues of Zap before it became a group effort, I respect that he was trying new things and playing with, you know, basically playing with new toys. And some of it is an enjoyable kind of, I think, largely frivolous on its surface. But there's things I liked, things I did not like. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the infamous strips, which gets talked about in the documentary, Joe Blow, where it's the whole, you know, it's the satire of the Leave It to Beaver kind of era of the nuclear family of mom and dad and the two kids in the perfect suburban home. And it turns out they're all committing incest. It's a pretty gross strip. I never liked it. Even when I was young, I was kind of like, ugh, this is gross. So yeah, you know, it's one size does not fit all. You know, cute little bearsy wearsies. That's cute. It's fine. Doesn't bother me.
Well, I think what's important here is that I think what we need more of is two, middle-aged or older white men discussing the, contemporary. I think there's a lot of value in that. So, no, anyway, just had to point that out for preempt any response to this. No, but yeah, and I don't know if we'll – sometimes we get into the breakdown of the beat for beat. I don't think we're going to do that. This seems like more of an overview. Me as a comics nerd, I have to say one thing, which is – so issue one is the only all-Crum, and then issue two, it turns into an anthology. And then issue zero, my understanding is Crum made that before issue one and it got misplaced or something. And then he re-inked it from Xeroxes. So it was created before issue one. So it's in release order, the third issue. And it's an all-Crum issue also. So it goes 1, 2, 0, 3, 4, which is how many we read. Yeah, my notes for issue four is gets pretty formulaic juvenile rape stories. Like issue four is basically the rape issue, which is just,
Yeah, I read to issue four.
Yeah.
And, well, okay, so here's where we're getting into other things and the other contributors. And
yeah,
here's where some of my perceptions have changed as I got older. Two of the guys who, when I was younger, didn't do a lot for me because, you know, generally I'm a narratively driven reader. But the two guys who really, like, their stuff really stands out and holds up are Rick Griffin and Victor Moscoso.
Yeah.
Their stuff is beautiful.
Yeah.
And, you know, is it narratively engaging? No. But because both of those guys definitely have their, you know, origins in poster art, they were very much part of the whole, you know, hippie music scene, poster art scene. Moscoso's drawing has always been impeccable. And so to look at his strips, they're just visually so pleasing. They're the only things in there where I feel like they might even be better in color. You know, most of the stuff is perfect in black and white, but you look at his and think, oh, with the right color, these things would just, they'd explode off the page. But they're gorgeous, and they're, you know, pretty, I don't, unless I'm misremembering, I don't think there's anything in them that's particularly offensive or, you know, I don't think that's where his head was at, really. I think he was a very visually driven person. And Rick Griffin, you know, who famously was the very devout born again Christian of the group. You know, he his stuff again, it's more towards the visual. When you read the dialogue, it's like, well, this is completely inane. But the visuals are really, they're impeccable. I mean, he had there's a high level of craft, there's a high level of design. Then the other end of the spectrum, and I never connected with S. Clay Wilson. I always found his stuff, you know, again, I can see the value of it in terms of when it was being done, who he was. I don't, you know, I don't hate it. And there are things I've enjoyed in small doses. But like his stuff was so gravitated so much towards ugliness. And I don't just mean ugly drawing, but just ugly behavior. You know, it to me was kind of nihilistic in a way that even when I was at my youthful, most nihilistic phase, it just was off-putting to me. I understand some people love it, and great, good for them. But I just, it doesn't, it never connected for me. And revisiting it now, it wasn't like I suddenly had an epiphany. It was still like, oh yeah, boy, oh boy, I just don't, this just doesn't speak to me.
Yeah, I had a pretty similar response to all those. So, yeah, Victor Moscoso and Rick Griffin, like almost like a formal approach to the page and things like that, like not very narrative based. So it's not like something I want to sit and read a book of necessarily, but I really there, you know, in the first issue, Crumb does Ultra Super Modernist Comics, which is sort of like using that, like creating compositions on the page. And it seems like they almost rolled with that. And I like it. I mean, I like it for what it is. And then, so yeah, both those guys, I, you know, was happy with what they were doing. I saw the aesthetic qualities. And then, yeah, I never had really sat down and read S. Clay Wilson comics before. And I did hate them. That's like, if we were going to do the beat by beat, I was just going to kind of say, like, I hated what he was doing, and I don't have anything more to add to any it's all just like, ah, these lesbians are killing these bikers and now they're pulling their dicks out. And I don't like with Crumb, you know, I can look at, you know, Ooga Booga and be like, that's appalling. You know, it's an appalling thing. It's well drawn, but it's appalling. And then S. Clay, well, I don't visually like it. I don't narratively like it. It was just, and they're long too. Like that was tedious. I don't think I read the last couple of his things because I was just like, there's nothing more to cull from these. It's just really unpleasant. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, I mean, in a, it's funny because I'm sure they would not want to be categorized this way, but Griffin and Moscoso are almost like palate cleansers. It's kind of like, you know, between the courses, you get your little dish of sorbet, and it was like, oh, I feel refreshed. And then you know, you get an eye full of S. Clay Wilson. It's like, oh, fuck, I need another palate
Yeah,
cleanser.
right. Yeah, here comes more.
So, you know, there's something to be, I mean, you know, Alphonse Mucha was the king of the decorative arts. You know, there is high value in decorative arts, and I would say those guys were the Alphonse Mucha of Zap. There you go. There's a quote for you.
There's a tone to it too. Like I like, I don't know, they're almost these like contemplative landscapes or something. Like there's a good energy to their contribution too. Yeah, and then you get Gilbert Shelton comes in.
Yeah. Which you know, I like Gilbert Shelton. I've always liked Gilbert Shelton. And in a weird way, he is the odd man out. Because it's funny, when he tries to get a little dirty in one, it doesn't feel right. It's almost like you can feel he's thinking, oh, geez, everyone else is doing it. I guess I have to do it. Gilbert Shelton, you know, his speaking again of people who cut their teeth with Harvey Kurtzman, you know, and in his case, college newspapers. He's more a make 'em laugh kind of guy. You know, he never was out to make big messages, which doesn't mean there aren't messages in his work. The Freak Brothers, you know, was satire of a very stoner ilk. But, you know, he was definitely pointing out the foibles going on in the world and all that. But it always was in such a good-natured way. Mm-hmm. If there was anyone in that group who doesn't have an axe to grind, it's Gilbert Shelton. Like, Gilbert Shelton is the only one in that group I'd really ever want to meet and spend any time with, because I bet he's just a lovely guy. You know, I'm in touch with his nephew a bit. And, but, you know, and I read that book, Dirty Pictures. Did you read that by Brian Daugherty? Really good book. I highly recommend it. Talk about a meticulously researched book. When that came out and I saw it was about underground comics, I was kind of on the fence, because I thought, well, I've read a lot about that. I probably, you know, what more is there? And then when I read it, I thought, geez, I only knew probably a quarter of what's in this.
That's cool. Good recommendation.
And,
yeah.
And a lot of what it gets into, really, in addition to contextualizing things and talking, it gets really into the interpersonal stuff between all of the creators all over the place and their feuds and their this and their that. But the one person in that book who you just think, that's the guy you want to know, it's Gilbert Shelton. Shelton just is like, yep, I like this guy. This is a good dude.
So, yeah.
And so, you know, reading Wonder Warthog, other than, you know, it maybe being a little, just a slight bit dirtier, than it's still pretty much an all-access kind of comic. The one where it gets a little dirty isn't. But as I say, that one just feels like a weird fit for him. I don't think he really ever got into that stuff very much.
I feel like the fourth issue, like, these guys sat down and said, okay, each story is going to have rape in it. And, like, it's the rape. I really think it was, like, not a mandate, but, like, because it's even Gilbert Shelton in that one. I love Gilbert Shelton. Like, I think... Yeah, my brothers had Freak Brothers comics that I read when I was, like, 8 or 9 years old. And, you know, there's some dicey stuff in there, but they're really... Well, his craft is really strong, too. Like, he's, like, very straightforward, quality craft person. And then they're good comics. Like, his phrasing is so precise, like, the way the characters speak to each other. There's so much funny kind of phrasing and language in those. And yeah, I don't think you have to be a stoner hippie at all to appreciate those comics. They're really funny. And yeah, Wonder Warthog, just as a premise, doesn't really appeal to me very much.
I mean, that to me is it's lesser. But, you know, again, it's him kind of figuring out his path forward. That's pre-Freak Brothers. You know, that Wonder Warthog started in the college newspaper. So, you know, that's kind of like a carryover from his pre-hippie era work. And I think I don't know. This is me speculating. I suspect he did a couple more of them in the hippie era and thought, yeah, this just doesn't really work anymore. And then you get the Freak Brothers.
Yeah. And, but I feel like of the underground, there is so much like, oh, it's of a time, or you know, and I feel like Gilbert Shelton just kind of, to me, he's top tier of that whole era of people. There's no caveats or anything. You can just kind of appreciate it for what it is and view the quality of it, and they're funny comics. Yeah.
Fantagraphics just put out all of the Freak Brothers stuff in hardcover books, and it reads really well. That stuff where you go back to it, because I hadn't seen all of it. I'd seen a lot of it, but not all of it. And, you know, when you've got it in this nice book and it's just like you're reading, it's like, this is really solid. Like, this is just good comics. And also, there isn't stuff where you're like, ooh, eesh.
There's a little bit, like, little orphan amphetamine. There's a little bit.
But, you know, I mean, it's drug culture-y. So, you know, I'm speaking as someone, this is one of these things. It's like, I think I'm the only person who ever was a regular contributor to High Times who's literally never taken a puff of a joint. You know, I am 100% a substance virgin. So I don't connect with that stuff on any level. To me, it's like purely spectator, rather, kind of thing. Drug culture has always bored bored me. I went through my phase of reading all of William S. Burroughs, and it's because he was such a great writer, but it's not like the whole junkie thing was like, hoo-hoo, I really want to get into that sewer. It's just like, oh, he wrote about it so eloquently and with great humor. It's like, okay, that's a good read. And the same with Freak Brothers, like, and to go slightly off topic for a second, one of the other underground guys who I in on a level of craft unimpeachable, Rand Holmes. He did sort of the almost like the competing title. He did Harold Head, so you've got Freak Brothers and then you've got Harold Head. Big adventures about going off to score weed and cocaine. I was like, okay, whatever, I don't care. Well done, comics.
Yeah, you can appreciate it for what it is. I think that's sort of the big. No, I mean, I got some notes. Keep on Truckin's in the first issue, Mr. Natural. The jam strips, which I think are very—they are what they are. They're not really much to read, but you can go, oh, this is cool that they were doing this. It's a creative endeavor.
Yeah, and we made no mention of I guess that's also the first appearance of Robert Williams in one of those issues. Or is he
Oh, I don't
after?
know.
Maybe he was, like I say, I accidentally read ahead and read it
Yeah.
before. But Williams, all right, so if he's not in the three, the 0 through 3, no
I
need to
don't
get into it,
think
other than to just
so.
say I think Williams is an amazing, absolutely amazing artist. And by the way,
Right on.
speaking of documentaries, the documentary about Robert Williams is great. Highly
Oh,
recommend.
okay. All right. We got some good recommendations. What's it called?
It's called Mr. Bitchin',
Okay.
and it's great. There's also a really, oh, we didn't talk about Spain either, but there's also a really good documentary about Spain
I don't think
that
he's
was.
in these, right? He shows up after what we read, I
Oh,
think.
I thought he might have had something in issue 3.
I don't think so.
Maybe not.
And
Maybe not.
then, the Vision of the Future strip from
You're
number
right.
zero, also one of the predictions that did become true. As he says, everyone will be tuned into everything that's happening all the time. That was
Yeah.
like, because it's not really like I did read the future with Peter Bagwin for the Dan Clowes 8-Ball episode, and it was a little bit like, oh, this did turn out this way, and this, and Crumb's predictions are more sort of bizarre, but that was the one where you're like, oh, that's actually we got there, and it didn't turn out very well.
Yeah, well, the fun actually, just to I'm going to usurp or at least trespass on 8-Ball for 1 second, but
Yeah.
since it's appropriate because it was in the future strip and that's what we're talking about, he does kind of prefigure, but in an analog way, the internet, because there's one panel I remember where he's talking about, I think it's somebody who either collects or sculpts little figures of, I think it's Abraham Lincoln made out of earwax. And he's
Oh,
saying how, like, no hobby, no matter how obscure, there will be a publication dedicated to it. So, of course, it's not a publication, but we know that there's a website or a Reddit group or whatever for every conceivable thing.
yeah.
So, yeah, you know.
Do you have one? Do you have an ultra niche hobby that you participate in?
I don't think I do. I'm a very vanilla person. I really, it's like, there's nothing outre about, my tchotchkes are pretty much like, I've got my little case of tchotchkes over there, but it's like, yeah, it's nobody's gonna say, oh boy, you're into weird stuff. I've got, the Beatles' Yellow Submarine and Frankenberry, it's like whatever, it's pop culture.
Yeah, I have those Beatles Yellow Submarines too. I bought them when they came out, and my daughter, who's now 4, has been so they're actually getting broken, but she knows all the Beatles names. She knows Paul McCartney and George. You go, which one's this? Oh, that's Ringo Starr. So it's worth it.
You say
But
that was Ringo Starr.
it's John Lennon with no hands. Yeah, but it's worth it. Well, cool. Do you have any final thoughts about these or anything or?
Well, I mean, my, depending on who's listening, You know, if you're, I won't say I'm an old, but I'm at least adjacent. I'm a borderline old. You know, you can look back at this stuff and sort of grimace at some of it, and some of it you can feel nostalgic about, and other stuff you can say, oh, that's still pretty good. But really, in terms of, I think, all of these guys who were in Zap, and they were all guys, it was definitely a boys' club. That's a whole other topic. But I really think all their best work was ahead of them. You know, it's interesting to look at these as sort of proto Crumb and proto Robert Williams, and I mean S. Clay Wilson, whatever. Don't need to keep banging that drum. But you know, I think really their best work was ahead of them, and that's fine. You know, they were very young, and they got better. You know, and that's what you really hope. I don't, you know, I don't need to go into it at length because we already did. But you know, Crumb, I think, really had all of his great work came later. I think once he was not taking LSD all the time, and you know, just kind of just began really focusing more on the dreaded other dreaded C word, craft, you know, when he really was just crafting incredible work where it did have something to say. And you know, he was being more introspective in a way that, as you said, paved the way for guys like Chester Brown and the late Joe Matt and myself. You know, I mean, without that stuff, whether I kind of hedged and made mine fictionalized autobiography without Crumb, et cetera, you know, Crumb and Justin Green, RIP Justin Green. I didn't know about Justin Green until I was well into my adulthood. But when, you know, when I finally did discover Binky Brown, it was like, oh yeah, wow, okay. This is definitely the archetypal, look at me and all of what I'm wrestling with and trying to compartmentalize and make peace with and so forth. So that's a whole other thing. By the way, that's another great documentary, that recent documentary about Justin Green and Carol Tyler. What's it called? Married to Comics. It's great.
I don't know that one either. Right
It's
on.
really good, and it's beautifully made and very emotional because it's really just about dealing with some pretty heavy stuff. And I you know, I wish I'm drawing a blank on the name of the documentarian, but he did a beautiful job. He also did a documentary about Skip Williamson. So there you go, another documentary. A lot of documentaries about these underground people.
Yeah, we've got
Everyone
we're kind of
knows
in that
Crumb, but
here.
they don't know all these other ones, and they're out there.
Yeah, we've gotten some good documentary recommendations from this, so that's good. Yeah, I mean, I think in conclusion, no, I agree. These are, I think proto is a good word for it. These are rough around the edges. These aren't you, but you have to look at the context, and these are really like blowing the door off of what, I mean, even in terms of what audience comics are for and what you can do with comics. And it's just, these are pivotal game changer works, even if sitting down to read them, they're not, the experience you would want to have from sitting down and reading comics necessarily. But this is a pathway to something that we're all living with now. I really think you need these to get where we are now. And I think we're in a pretty cool place with comics now of genre possibilities and conceptual possibilities.
Yeah, and again, I'm not going to judge because, you know, I mean, I also think it is a consequence of youth, and particularly when you're wired a certain way. You know, let's face it, probably with the exception of S. Clay Wilson and Robert Williams, there's, you know, these are nerds, angry nerds. Angry nerds who the girls didn't talk to until, you know, drugs came into the scene or this and that. And, you know, so, you know, when I look at work that I did when I was really young, some of it I'm just like, oh, Jesus, you know, why did you do this? You know, that kind of pent up stuff, it comes out somehow. And, you know, better to be drawing a gross comic than going out and being violent or this and that. You know, you have to do something with these sort of antisocial or frustrated or frightened, you know, all these things that kind of contribute to venting. You know, there's a lot of you're doing it quote unquote creatively, but you're venting, you know, and some of this obviously clearly was venting. So, you know, you hope as you mature, you kind of learn to do something either, I'm not an advocate of suppressing, but, you know, this is where compartmentalizing and all that comes into play, where you're just like, okay, you know what, maybe I don't need to invest so much energy in something so antisocial. You know, maybe I don't have to be as offensive as I possibly can be, or this or that. You know, there's definitely, being provocative was clearly part of what they were doing, because it really was like, I'll show you. You tell me I can't do, I'll show you.
Yeah,
I'll show you everything.
Yeah.
So like, okay, especially if you're coming out of the uptight 1950s. Yeah, again, that's what this is. So, yeah, just frame it for what, when, and who.
And yeah, I think too, there's like, how much weight do you want to give it? Like, I think Crumb's representation of black people is pretty objectionable, and that work is still around and we still talk about it. So there's a conversation to be had there. But I think S. Clay Wilson's pirate comics where the gay pirates are fighting lesbians was just so stupid.
Yeah.
And like not worth my mental energy that I was just like, that's it. Like I'm not going to get mad about this. I'm just going to flip through it and move on. So, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, there's a danger when your satire can be, I mean, when you do satire straight faced, it can be taken very literally. Mm-hmm. And many, 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 many years later, decades later, you know, Crumb infamously in the final issue of Weirdo did two strips which were so kind of played so straight, and I know they were done satirically, but they ended up getting reprinted without his permission in, I think it was, I don't remember which Nazi publication, but it was like the Daily Stormer or one of those. I don't know. I don't want to plug those assholes. Mm. But, you know, he did two strips. One was, I think it was called, I don't even want to say the titles, but let's say just one was about when the Jews take over and when the blacks take over. And I know he meant them satirically, but if you just read them on the surface, it's just, that is a capital W yikes, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily think, you know, he felt that way, but he felt that way enough to be able to get it out of his system in a way that kind of straddles that, you know? So, yeah, again, you can sort of pick and choose what you love and what you just, I don't know, either overlook or just say, well, I don't know.
I think two works that provoke discussion and discourse I think there's value to that's sort of, to me, again, the difference between Art Crumb and S. Clay Wilson, where Crumb, you go, oh, well, let's talk about this. Let's kind of engage with it and evaluate it and think about it. Whereas S. Clay Wilson is just like, I don't have time for this. So I don't know. I think there's something to that, too. I don't want to plug those assholes, I think that's my quote for you. I'm going to put that on the front of, that's just a good phrase that I'll use a lot. Bob Fingerman, I don't want to plug those assholes.
Well, let's remember it's in the context of the neo-Nazis, not the people we're here to talk about.
You don't want to plug their assholes, the neo-Nazis. That's good. Okay, I'll keep it in mind.
Oh, heavens. What's happened?
What's happened?
This was such a thoughtful discourse. And now see what happens. You talk about underground comics and it all eventually ends up in the gutter.
It's infected our minds. So as we wrap up, I ask everyone, do you have a dream run? Do you have something you've always wanted to do or see in runs of comics?
Not really. I mean, in myself, I've never really wanted to draw anybody else's characters or anything.
Yeah.
So like if it was like, oh, if I know a lot of people, oh, if you were offered an opportunity to do this or that, it's nah, I'd rather do my own thing.
Yeah.
Once upon a time, I by the way, there are things I would happily write. That's a whole other thing.
Throw it at me. Yeah.
So, you know, would I like to play with Snake Plissken from Escape from New York? I would happily write Snake Plissken. Mm. I wouldn't want to draw it, though.
Who would you want to have draw it?
Just someone who's probably more, would have a greater affinity for drawing that kind of more realistic type stuff. Dan Panosian, who's a great mainstream comic artist who I think just gets better and better and better in a way that's almost irritating.
Yeah, that's true, Dan Panosian. I agree with that, yeah.
So, like, yeah, if there was, I can answer your question, just not in terms of it being me writing and drawing, but if I could write a run of a Snake Plissken adventure that Dan would draw, I would be very happy about that. That would be
great. All right, you heard it here first. Yeah.
But I'd rather just kind of stay in my lane and keep doing my own stuff.
Well, speaking of that, what do you want to plug?
Oh, well, yeah, I have a new graphic novel out called Printopia from Cosmic Lion Productions. And I'm really, really proud of it. It's
all right.
I also think it's the best looking, just in terms of physical package, the best looking book I've had come out.
Oh, cool.
My publisher, a really lovely fella named Eli Schwab, bless his soul, he gave me everything I asked for. Because I said, okay, you know, before we do this, are you okay doing it in hardcover? And he said, yes. And I said, are you okay with it doing it oversized? And he said, yes. And so, because that's one thing, and maybe it's a consequence of getting older, but also I just kind of like when things are printed a little larger. Because the artwork gets to breathe, you know. That's the one thing about comics is they're so squished in a way. So, you know, he put out exactly what I wanted it to be. But I think it's in a way it kind of actually dovetails very nicely with our conversation, because really it's a book about kind of outsider creative oddballs, you know, these people. And by the way, one of them, you know, I would say it's probably the most empathetic book I've done, because with the exception of one character, he's the one character who gets denied service by the print shop that is the framing device, and because his work is objectionable. And the main character, Darla Vogel, who has appeared in other books of mine, she's just like, nah, you're not, we're denying you service. But in the context of like underground comics and people, one of the characters in the book is a guy who came along. He's 66 years old, so he's just a little too young to have been part of the original underground comics movement. He was sort of part of that post-underground movement. And so he feels like he never quite slotted in. And so you've got each one of the story, it's very episodic. There are vignettes about all of the patrons of this print shop. And each chapter is kind of drawn, I won't say in a different style, but a different visual kind of look to each one. So it was really fun to do. And the back of the book has a dossier of samples of the work by the characters. So that was really cool to do, because it was a way to draw in different styles and write in different styles and kind of present it all very much as like, so here's the work by these people. And even the one who gets denied service, I wanted to have one page. So it's a facsimile of like one of those look insides that you would see on Amazon. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I think it's a really fun book. And, you know, I think it, first and foremost, is entertaining, but I do think it wrestles with and grapples with the creative urge and things that creators particularly have to deal with, like imposter syndrome and am I good enough and all that kind of thing. So I think there's actually some substance to it. So that would be my plug.
Printopia. Well, I can't wait to go buy it. Printopia. Right on. Everyone who listens should buy two copies. And yes, where can I find you online?
Instagram's probably best. Just Bob Fingerman. Couldn't be easier.
Yeah, it's nice to have a name that fits as a Instagram handle. I do not have that ability. But all right, Instagram, I follow you already. So no work for me to do. But everyone else listening, check it out. Cool. Well, thanks so much for doing the show. Nice talking to you about
Zapped
Comics. Yeah.
Likewise. As you know, I had some concerns because I definitely didn't want to seem negative, and I don't think that happened. So
okay,
I think we did okay.
I mean, we're both cartoonists. I think we both live a life where you are very opinionated. You say what you think, and then you go home and you go, what did I just say? How will it be perceived?
Yeah, well, I think that's another consequence, or I would say in this case, a benefit of getting older and maturing, is because I'm very conscious, much more conscious now than when I was younger, of, you know, I don't want to upset people. And I also want to be sensitive to people's feelings. You know, it's all well and good to speak your mind. But if you're doing it where it's just sort of not taking into consideration other people. Also, it's who needs to expend that much energy on negativity? Mm. There's not a lot of upside to that.
This is recorded on January 10th, 2025. We'll check in 10 days about that. But yes.
Well, that is when I burrow into the ground.
Yeah.
And just try to focus on my work and the people I love and the people I care about. That's the other thing. Okay, yeah, if we're going to end on a certain note, I'm just going to make a very broad assumption that probably most of your listeners are not Trumpers. And
yeah.
They're not running around exulting in, the second coming of their Lord. If you can, either refocus your energies on things that you actually can impact. You know, if you are super angry and upset and so forth, there are, I guess, things you can do. You can join local committees to help people if you're so inclined. But mainly just try to focus on being kind and being patient and loving the people you love and surviving the people you don't.
Well, and I think, too, like, as it relates to comics culture, I think, you know, you said these are nerds, and I think that's true. And when I see infighting in comics, I kind of often feel that way. Like, we're all nerds. We're all back of the classroom drawing in our margins while class is happening, and we're all last picked for kickball, and let's support each other. You know, we have our differences, and that's true, but let's really look at the big picture here, and let's work out our differences as well as we can, and let's support each other. I really feel that way. So
I think that's great. Yes, I agree. Stop eating our own and try to support each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, good meeting, and see you in the funny pages.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Thus concludes our interview with Bob Finger Man. I like that his name is a sentence. You know, I went back and forth a lot on cutting that ending out, but I wasn't sure where to cut it off. And also, I don't know, it's what he said. I'm not good at cutting stuff out. That was recorded a week before the inauguration, and, you know, I think probably viewpoints have changed. It seems naive in hindsight, maybe. I think we all were like, well, let's keep my head down. Keep my head down. I don't know. I'm recording this outro in the middle of September, probably post it in 3-4 weeks, and probably a lot will be different between now and then, too. I don't know how to talk about important issues on this platform, but, you know, if it seems a little naive or idealistic, we just weren't there yet, you know? We just weren't there yet. Nothing had happened yet in this round. Anyway, so let's talk about comic books. So, appreciate Bob Fingerman coming on. Great cartoonist. Just a real cartoonist, you know? He's one of these guys who's been doing it a long time. Someone you could all look up to. And a very good painter, too. I wish I had talked to him more about painting. I've always just been interested in what he has to say. He's just very, very skilled crafting of work, all his work. That guy can really craft images. Anyhow, it's cool to talk with him about Zap Comics. Appreciate him coming on, and be sure to check out his book, and you can check out my website. Oh, yes, very nice. Oh, please rate and review this show on all platforms, whatever platforms you're listening to. Tell people about it, you know, just tell everyone about it. It's the Runs podcast, and you can find me at oyesverynice.com or oyesverynice at Gmail. You can email me, or oyesverynice is my Twitter, Instagram handle. I'm not on Twitter anymore. That's not even a thing anymore. Anyway, thanks for listening to the show, and I'm just self-conscious about what we said. Like I said, I'd be... And see you next week for more talking about comic books and probably segues about other things.